This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, 1 hour to go, and it's going to go quickly. So if you've been thinking about calling, I encourage you to call now, 888-914-9149. Lots of ground to cover, but it will be done before you know it. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to St. Charles, Illinois, and talk to Vince. Hi, Vince.
Hi, Patrick. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Modern dating nowadays is guided by a hookup culture, which is perpetuated by dating apps. It seems to be littering the internet sphere, whether that be Facebook, Instagram, or anything of that sort. And I'm curious about how someone my age would go about this and find someone with God in their heart. I'm hoping to start a family one day, but it's discouraging when nobody seems interested anymore.
I can imagine. I haven't dated for 40... Well, I dated my wife, I guess, before we got married. But other than that, I haven't dated for over 40 years. So I don't have a clue about some of the pressures that young people experience right now, except for being aware of things like Tinder and other apps like that. So my fundamental advice would be, don't put those apps on your phone. Don't try to find people on those apps, because you're not going to be finding the right kind of people. You're not going to be finding a girl who is a good candidate for marriage, because if she's on Tinder, you know, I think that the likelihood of her, let's just say, not being virtuous is probably pretty high. Same for the guys. So I would just ignore all that nonsense and go where the good girls are. Find them in, for example, the Association of Young Professional Catholics. I'm probably mangling the name, but there are organizations that are very successful all around the country. I'm sure there's probably a chapter in your area. You're near St. Louis, right? In St. Charles? That's near St. Louis?
St. Charles, Illinois.
Oh, Illinois. I'm sorry.
Kind of near Chicago.
Illinois. Okay, that's right. Well, definitely in Chicago. So Young Catholic Professionals, I believe, is the name. Just do a little Googling. And so you'll find at some of these meetings, you might find 100, 200 young men and women who are there because they're Catholic and they're involved in a career of some sort and they want to meet each other and they're interested in growing their faith and such. That'd be a good place to go, as one example, to find a good group of girls that you can begin to see if there's somebody there who really appeals to you and you can maybe strike up a friendship. Maybe it's a youth group through your diocese. I know that in the Diocese of Sacramento, there is a group called To the Heights. And I only know about that group because one of my former students at Franciscan University, she actually met her future husband by being part of that group. And they would go on hikes and they would do other adventures as a big group. And eventually she and he found each other and they have a wonderful, happy marriage with several children. So I know it can be done, but my advice fundamentally then would just be go where you're going to find the right kind of girl, and you'll find her eventually. If that's God's will for you, you'll find her.
Thank you so much for your advice, Patrick. God bless you.
Thank you, Vince. Let's see. Let's go to Sunny now in Austin, Texas. Probably Sunny in Austin, Texas. Hello, Sunny.
Oh, no, it's raining, Patrick. That's why I can call you today, because I'm not working. So maybe expect some more calls during the week. It's supposed to be raining.
We'll take them all.
So I store up questions for moments just like this.
Okay. So what would you like to talk about today?
The assumption.
Okay.
So I assume, obviously, that goes all the way back to, the time of Mary. But I also know, wasn't it declared a dogma like 1950 or somewhere around there?
Right.
And I also know that usually when things are definitively declared or put in a creed, it's because there's some opposition or some question about it. And so I'm just wondering if you have any explanation or comments on that big period between the time of Jesus, the time of Mary, all the way to 1950, and why there's that big gap and then all of a sudden the declaration of a dogma.
Okay. Yeah, I'll offer some thoughts. First of all, the fact of the bodily assumption of Mary would have been known by the earliest people who would have known her, and that, of course, would be the apostles. The Bollandists, which is it's a group of Jesuit scholars that goes back several centuries. Part of their work was to gather up as much documentation as possible on some of these issues and then compile them into historical works so that as much information as they could find would be brought together in a volume. And so they have recorded and drawn together the mentions that are made of Our Lady's bodily assumption. And part of that, in the earliest part of it, is known as the Transitus literature. And, I mean, you can look that up in the Catholic Encyclopedia online and read more about it. But it's referring to the translation of Our Lady from this life into eternal life, and that God brought her forth, brought her into heaven, body and soul, as a special privilege. We have to wait to get our bodies back until the end of the world, but she received that blessing from God. And that also meant that her body did not decay in the grave. But in any case, the historical gap between when it actually happened and when it first started to be written about could be understood in one way, and that would be that in the intervening period, there were tremendous persecutions against the church, and there was very little that could be written, at least not in any great way, about some of these things. It seems that once the church was free from persecution by the beginning of the fourth century, that then it could breathe again and kind of come up out of the catacombs, figuratively speaking. And that's when you begin to see a profusion of literature, Christian literature, written about these kinds of topics, including this one. Now, why did Pope Pius XII wait until 1950? Or why did no pope before him decide to define this dogma? As I understand it, and I'm not an expert on this topic, but as I understand it, there was an increasing amount of requests coming in from bishops and cardinals and priests and faithful throughout the world asking that this doctrine, which had been believed all along, should be defined as a dogma. And I'll offer you an historical parallel, and that would be with regard to the Trinity. What you'll find is that, of course, the Trinity, one God in three persons, was always true. It was the teaching of the church, even though in the very first years, the first century into the second century, perhaps, there was still a great deal of flux in terms of our understanding of that doctrine and the ability to start defining terms to speak about that. So the whole taxonomy, the theological taxonomy of the Trinity, and even Christological issues as well, they were developing over time. And so by the time you get to the year 325, nearly 300 years had passed from the time of Jesus until then. And it's only then that we see the church formally defining the dogma of the Trinity, and as well as the divinity of Christ. So it doesn't mean that it changed. It doesn't mean that it was, you know, it wasn't true before, but it suddenly became true. But rather, at that point in time in the life of the church, the Emperor Constantine, for his part, he said, let's convene a council so that we can deal with the Arian question, the Arian challenge to the faith that teaches that there's one God in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So in a way similar to that, it seems that Pope Pius XII, he deemed it to be appropriate that given the questions or the petitions rather that were coming in for him to formalize this doctrine that the church believed but had never formally defined, he felt it was the right time to do that. Now, beyond that, you'll have to have the experts give you more specifics, but I think that's the by and large of it. I hope that helps, and I appreciate the call. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Plainsboro, New Jersey, and talk to Tom. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Question, just out of, trying to clarify and understand. When the Pharisees, et cetera, in front of Pilate, they kept saying, we have no authority to, you know, for a death sentence to kill him. But throughout the Gospels, he's constantly being threatened with being stoned to death. So I'm trying to understand those two things. How do those things blend together?
Yeah, well, they certainly had the authority from Moses to stone to death somebody who blasphemed God. I think that what they were doing was they were weaseling. They were trying to manipulate the situation and get Pilate to do their dirty work, which they were successful in doing. So what the precise reasons were, did they think that maybe there wouldn't be enough people who would try to stone Jesus? Would his followers prevent that from happening? Maybe would there be some division among the people if they tried to stone Jesus to death? And would that maybe diminish their power or influence? Maybe that's possible. So my reading of it is, and I'd be interested in consulting, what did the church fathers say and what did scholars say? But my take is that they wanted Pilate to do their dirty work. So they manipulated him into this position where he, as the symbol of Roman authority, secular authority as opposed to religious, he did this for them. And they got what they wanted, but they didn't have, you know, they were able to say, well, the Romans did it, you know, according to their laws, Jesus committed this crime, so it's on them. So that's my take on that, Tom.
Okay, interesting. I didn't know whether one of the elements may be that they wanted, as they were, you know, these situations kept coming up and they never worked out, that obviously they never did stone him, but they wanted the most humiliating, most public death possible to really dissuade anyone from believing him, because it was such a humiliating type of way to die.
Mm-hmm. That's possible. You know, who knows what evil thoughts were lurking in their hearts? The Bible doesn't specifically say that to us, so that's conjecture, but it's not unfounded. I just don't know. You know, maybe some of them, that was their motive, but at the very least, the Bible doesn't tell us that that's why they did that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You got it, Tom. Thank you. Let's go now to Ann, listening in Chicago. Good morning, Ann.
I have a six-year-old son, and he and I participate in a volunteer group. Lately, he's noticed a homosexual couple arriving and leaving, and he's had questions about that. My husband and I tell them they're friends because we certainly don't want to broach the topic of human sexuality for some time, but we wonder if that's sufficient.
I think it probably would be. Does that seem to satisfy his curiosity when you tell him that?
Yes, he asked my husband, and then he asked me on separate occasions. So we're keeping our fingers crossed, hoping that did the trick. But is that honest to him? And is that what you would advise?
I think it is, yeah, because he's, you know, 6 years old. He not only can he not really comprehend what's going on there, but also he shouldn't have to know about that. So if he said, "Mommy, why are those two men holding hands?" I mean, was it something like that? I mean, he must have picked up on something that made him wonder.
He did. It's actually two women, and, you know, they sometimes rub each other's backs or something like that during, you know, the meetings, and he sees them arriving and leaving in the same car. Yeah. So we just said, you know what, they're friends, and we kind of changed the subject.
I think that's the wise course of action. I really do. And, you know, when it comes up again as he gets older, you know, then you have to be more specific with him. But if he seems satisfied at 6 years of age with that answer, then I think that's the best way to do it. So it'd be similar, I guess, Ann, is if he were saying, "Mommy, where do babies come from?" "Oh, well, babies come from mommy's tummy." "Oh, okay. Remember when you saw your little sister when she came along, and before that she was in mommy's tummy?" "Yeah, I remember that." "Well, that's where babies come from." And more often than not, that's enough. It's like, "Oh, okay. And then what's for lunch?" Now, as he gets older, you know, then you have to elaborate more as it's age appropriate. But right now, it's not age appropriate, as you already know. So I think you're doing
wonderful.
The right thing.
Easy enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your help, Patrick. God bless.
You're welcome, man. God bless you. And that little lad, he's perceptive. Not, you know, a lot of kids, it would just, like, they wouldn't even notice. So, there's an example of a child who's really paying attention to what's going on. How about Rose now in St. Cloud, Minnesota? Hi, Rose.
Hi. Thank you, Patrick, for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a grandson in his early 20s, says he is an atheist. Okay. Can you suggest any resources that would be helpful to him?
Many. I would suggest Father Robert Spitzer's excellent website, CredibleCatholic.com, which is a website.
Pardon me? I'm writing this down. S-P-I-T.
Yeah.
S-P-I-T.
Yeah, I'll spell it out for you. So S-P-I-T-Z-E-R, Father Robert Spitzer. And the website is CredibleCatholic.com. And that will lead you to other resources by Father Spitzer. But he's a very articulate, very intellectual and effective exponent of Christian theism and a critic of theism, of atheism. But he does it in a very cheerful way. So it's not pushy or mean-spirited. So anything by Father Robert Spitzer, I would hardly endorse. I would also humbly suggest a book that I co-authored with Ken Hensley. The book is called The Godless Delusion. And rather than do what so many other authors have done so well, which is to explain the case for theism, the case for why we believe in God, what Ken Hensley and I did is we took the approach of let's offer a critique of atheism. Let's take atheism and its claims and subject that to a critique. So that might be a book that would be helpful. Again, it's called The Godless Delusion. I would recommend, if your grandson is an avid reader, I would recommend a book, well, two more books. One would be by Dr. Peter Kraft and Father Ron Tesselli. You don't have to know the names. It's not that important. Dr. Peter Kraft's last name is spelled K-R-E-E-F-T, if you need to search it that way. But that book is called Handbook of Catholic Apologetics, and it is it's a tour de force of taking all of the major and most of the minor arguments that are raised against belief in God by atheists, and in that part of the book anyway, and they just refute them one by one. It's like setting up bowling pins. You set them up, they knock them down. You set them up, they knock them down. So that's a very good book. I teach apologetics at a couple of different college universities. One is a college, one is a university. And that's a textbook that my students are required to read, especially in that regard. The last thing, if I don't want to inundate you, but the last one I'd recommend is a book by Dr. Edward Faeser. His last name is spelled F-E-S-E-R. It looks like Fesser, but he pronounces it Faeser. And it is called The Last Superstition. And it is a single volume takedown. It's a critique of atheism. And it's very good. I refer to Edward Faeser as kind of a chainsaw when it comes to dealing with arguments. He's just very good at that. There are a few others. So as long as we're at it, I would recommend a book by David Bentley Hart. It is called, let me see if I can get the actual name of it again. It is called Atheist Delusions, The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. And the author's name is David Bentley Hart, H-A-R-T. That's very good. And then lastly, I would suggest that you send your son or grandson a link to a debate between William Lane Craig, a Protestant philosopher, and Christopher Hitchens. It's called the Biola Debate, B-I-O-L-A. That's the name of the Protestant college in La Mirada, California, where this was held some years ago. And it's a debate on the question of, does God exist? And the late Christopher Hitchens was regarded as one of the foremost modern atheists. And William Lane Craig is considered one of the foremost Christian philosophers / apologists. And it's a very good debate. And Christopher Hitchens doesn't win it. So that would be another thing that you could show him. That way it's clear that you're not wanting him only to see Christian sources, but you're encouraging him to see what the best of the atheists have to say and how their views can be refuted. So there's a lot there on your list, but hopefully one or more of those things will be helpful.
Oh, I know my grandson. This last one that you mentioned, I would like to make sure I have the correct link to this debate, because I think that would be a good one for him as I listen.
Here's how you get it. Go to YouTube and type in Biola Debate, B-I-O-L-A, Biola Debate, Does God Exist? And you'll find it.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much. This is very helpful.
You're most welcome, Rose. Nice to chat with you. That is the perfect time for us to take a break, and we'll come back with more of your phone calls right after this. The number to dial, 888-914-9149. A line just opened up. You can grab it, but you got to call now. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, moving rapidly to the end of the hour. Give me a call, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Gerard in Milwaukee, welcome to the program, sir.
Hello, Patrick, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. So, we're nearing the end of the Easter season with Pentecost coming up, and so you make yourself familiar at this time of the year with some of the Gospels in the New Testament. So I was looking through the Gospel of John, and I was trying to see where on the night of the Last Supper in the Gospel of John did our Lord Jesus Christ put or talk about the institution of the Eucharist, the establishment of the institution of the Eucharist. I couldn't find it. And then in reading Matthew, Mark, and Luke, I was trying to figure out whereabouts in those three Gospels did they talk about Jesus washing the feet of the disciples. Am I missing something, or is it just an interesting coincidence? Or
no, I mean you're not missing anything that I can think of, but you're wondering about where does the Last Supper appear in the different Gospels? Is that what you mean?
I'm wondering about the specific part of John's Gospel that talks about Jesus establishing the institution of the Eucharist. I mean, I know that he talks later on in John's Gospel that there is, he makes reference to communion, but I just, like in Matthew, Mark, okay, and Luke, I think they specifically use the term the institution of the Eucharist. I just didn't see it in John's. So I guess I'm imagining in my mind, if Matthew, Mark, and Luke never showed up, and all that survived was John's Gospel, would we still have the institution of the Eucharist?
Yes, and so the Synoptic Gospels, which are different from John's Gospel, they all give an account of the Last Supper. So Matthew 26, John 13 is where we see the references from St. John's Gospel. But Matthew 26 and Matthew, let me stop, I'm tripping over my words. Matthew chapter 26, 17 through 20, and then also 26 through 29 is where you see that there. The Johannine, or the John version of this, which tracks with what you see in Matthew 26 and also in Luke 22, that covers several chapters. So John 14, John 15, John 16, and John 17. So that high priestly prayer that Jesus prays at the end is the culmination of the Last Supper sequence. But the Gospel of John does not refer to the Eucharist in the way that the others do. Earlier in John 6, as you probably know, that's where Jesus gives a very forceful teaching on the Eucharist. But at the Last Supper, in the Last Supper accounts, we don't see an emphasis there in John's Gospel. So
it'd be interesting, and then if John's Gospel was the only one that survived, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic, didn't, if we'd have the institution of the Eucharist, wouldn't it? It's just kind of an odd question, you know what I mean?
No, it's not odd. I understand what you're saying, and it's reasonable to ask that question. One thing to not forget, though, is that we don't go by Scripture alone. So sacred tradition informs us of the meaning of Scripture so that we can know what Jesus meant by what he said. And those eyewitnesses, the apostles, they explained what Jesus meant. St. Paul talks about that, for example, in 1 Corinthians 11, where he says, in verse 2, he says, I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold fast to the traditions just as I handed them on to you. So those were all orally conveyed to the Corinthians, this being his first epistle to them. There was nothing in writing before that. He had taught them all these things verbally. In fact, even later in that same passage, he elucidates one of those traditions that he had taught them, and that is about what happened at the Last Supper. So
who he had to get that information from? The people who were there. So,
well, actually, he says, I received from the Lord what I also handed on to you. So in that case, unlike maybe other instances where he might have had to learn from St. Peter or St. John or one of the others what they saw. In this case, he received a direct revelation directly from Jesus, because he himself wasn't there, obviously. So that's a fascinating detail that he gives us.
And in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, am I missing where they talk about Jesus washing his apostles' feet prior to the meal, but prior to the Last Supper? Or
yes, I'd have to go back and do a comparison to see, you know, which one, which gospel has that and which one doesn't. But yes, that's the account
just an
that's given.
Thing,
in
I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I find it's interesting too, Gerard. I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you. Looking forward to our next conversation. Let's go now to Glenn, who's listening. Glenn? No. Oh, no, I'm sorry, not Glenn. Kent. I read it wrong. Sorry. Hi, Kent in Salinas, California.
Yes. Good morning, Patrick. Love your show. I was raised an Anglican, left the church, and then became a Catholic. I have relatives who are diehard Anglicans who think that Anglicans are like Catholics, just only better. How do you respond to that?
Well, I could say a few snarky things, but I wouldn't say that. Here's what I would say. I'd say that the Reformation in England, beginning with King Henry VIII, was a rejection of the authority of the Pope, and it was the claim that King Henry VIII made that he could establish his own church that he would be the head of. And he couldn't do that, but in any case, he thought he could do that, and he did it in the sense that he did fashion this church, but it has no authority, and its sacraments are, well, some of its sacraments are invalid because they don't have validly ordained priests. And, you know, so, I mean, there's so much I could say about this, but suffice to say that it's an illegitimate church because its founding was illegitimate. The basis for its founding was illegitimate. The history demonstrates that they lost the sacrament of holy orders. Keep in mind that when King Henry VIII went into schism and heresy, all the bishops of England and Wales, with the exception of one bishop, St. John Fisher, they all went into heresy. They all followed King Henry VIII. They didn't want to lose their heads. And so shortly after that time, because they had valid holy orders, so they could ordain priests validly, they could ordain deacons and even other bishops that could consecrate validly. But when the Puritans came in, and these were the Calvinists from the continent for the most part, and Puritan thought, Calvinist thought strongly imbued the Anglican Church, the Church of England, for a time, well, they completely did away with all anything that smacked in any way of the Catholic faith. So they gutted all of the ceremonies, all of the celebration of the sacraments that might have continued valid holy orders in the Church of England had they not done this. And then eventually, when the pendulum swung back away from the Puritan or the Calvinist wing and backed more toward a kind of an Anglo-Catholic balance, by then many generations had gone by and lots of invalid attempts at ordination had taken place. So they no longer had a validly ordained clergy. They had, in essence, laymen dressed up as priests and bishops, and that's all. And this actually was taken up by Pope Leo XIII around the time of the turn of the last century. And in this document, he said that Anglican holy orders are null and void. So this is part of the context of considering the Anglican Church. Their sacraments that are valid would include, say, baptism and holy matrimony, but they don't have a valid Holy Eucharist. They don't have valid confirmation. They don't have valid holy orders. So you can see the problem there. So for someone to say they're just like Catholics but better is kind of a fatuous statement. It doesn't really mean anything. So they have a kind of form. They resemble the Catholic Church in many external ways, but in the ways that really matter, it's a kind of an empty husk. Now, this I say this knowing that it might be offensive to certain people, and I don't mean it to be offensive to anybody. I really don't. And I'm not describing people per se. I'm describing the phenomenon of how the Church of England came into existence and what its existence actually means. So these are all things that have to be taken into consideration. If you want a book that will actually give you a very helpful overview of this, I would read the book called A History of the Protestant Reformation in England and Ireland by William Cobbett. Now, William Cobbett himself lived in England, and this book was written in the early 19th century. So I think it was written like in the 1820s. And he lived rather closer in time to the events in question, and he had access to many of the documents, and he knew the history very well, being an Englishman himself. And that book will give you a lot of the specifics that I don't have time to give you, but I would recommend it. And I think when you read that, you'll find out that the differences between Anglicans and Catholics are profound. They're not superficial.
Okay, thank you. Very helpful.
You got it, Kent. Sometimes I have the feeling that maybe if I answer a little too much. No, but I hope that's helpful to you, Kent. Thank you. Let's go to Dan now in Minneapolis. Good morning, Dan.
Morning, Patrick. I have a question for you in the research that I'm doing to try and get my son off the fence on whether or not he believes in God. Okay. And one of the roads I'm going down is I'm trying to determine what is true with regards to the effects of sin on generations to come. And I'm looking at Numbers 14, verse 18, and comparing it to Ezekiel 18, verse 20. They seem to contradict each other. I suspect they don't. And I was wondering if I could get clarification on that.
All right, well, let's take them in order. So Numbers 14, verse 18 says, "The Lord is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgression. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, upon the third and upon the fourth generation." Okay, so I'm with you on that one. So what is the other one? It was Ezekiel what?
Ezekiel 18, verse 20.
All right, let me go to that. So Ezekiel 18, verse 20. And then you'll tell, once I read it, then you'll tell me what the contradiction is that you see. It says, "The soul that sins shall die, the son shall not suffer for the iniquity of the father, nor the father suffer for the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself." Okay, I think I see the apparent contradiction. Tell me if I have it right. So in Numbers, it talks about God visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children for several generations. And in Ezekiel, it's saying that it won't happen. And the son doesn't suffer for the iniquity of the father. Okay. Here, I believe, is a solution to that apparent contradiction. It's not really a contradiction, but rather in the Numbers passage, it's saying that that God visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the children insofar as two things may obtain in this case. One may be, they actually both could obtain, or it could be one or the other. One possibility is that the sinfulness of the father is something that has repercussions in the lives of the children. It could be that maybe he squandered his fortune and now they have to live in poverty. So his sinfulness is now visited upon them in the form of they lack what they otherwise would have had. Could be poverty, could be disease. Maybe the father contracted syphilis by being unchaste, and now the children are suffering with disease as a result of what the father did. And we could multiply examples of that, but it can be understood in that sense. It could also be understood that the father taught his children vice. So like when dad has a stash of pornographic magazines, and then when his son is old enough, and believe me, this boggles my mind. I can't even imagine any father doing this, but I have known guys who have told me that when they got to be a certain age, their dad told them, okay, now you're old enough to know about this, and then shared that with his son. I've met guys, and there are, I'm sure, some guys who are listening right now who went through that, God forbid. But there would be an example, whether it's theft or lust or what have you, whatever it may be, where the father actually inducts his children into that life of vice. And so they then become complicit because they learn how to do it, and then they continue to do it, and that could pass down to generations. So either or both of those two things is what is happening or what is being referred to in Numbers 14. Now, the reason that doesn't conflict with Ezekiel is because in Ezekiel, it's talking about how the father who is guilty, his guilt does not transfer to the son who is not guilty. In other words, there's no moral culpability on the son if he is not doing what the father did. Now, he may have to suffer because the dad was, you know, sinful in the way he handled his money or other things. So he may deal with suffering, but the culpability, the sin itself does not transfer. That's what that's talking about there. So if you're good, it doesn't matter what somebody else did, your father or your son, that's not on you. That's on that person. You might have to deal with the consequences of that person's sin, but Ezekiel 18 is referring to guilt and culpability. Does that make more sense?
Yes, that makes a lot more sense. Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Happy to help, Dan. Thank you. Good time to take a break. We'll do that, and we'll come back with more phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We are back. I got a laugh when I saw this headline because it reminded me of something that happened to me long ago. I don't know, 25 years ago, something like that. Here's the headline. Brace yourself, okay? U.S. Airlines may start weighing passengers at the gate. Let me read that to you again. People are going, oh my gosh. U.S. Airlines may start weighing passengers at the gate. So what's going on here? U.S. Airlines may need to start weighing passengers in order to comply with FAA rules. For safety reasons, carriers need to calculate an aircraft's weight and balance, and it has to be within allowable limits for the plane. However, the assumptions they have been using for passengers are outdated. Americans are getting fatter, and the federal government wants airlines to find out how much fatter their passengers have gotten, at least for smaller aircraft. The FAA realizes that passengers' weight can vary by route, and airlines may want to document the difference. Standard weights may not be appropriate for smaller planes with smaller sample size and a greater likelihood of variance from the average. Airlines can use standard weights published by the CDC for larger aircraft with variance for winter and summer based on greater weight assumptions for clothing in winter. However, they outline a method for smaller aircraft to determine actual passenger and bag weights and to determine whether an aircraft up to 70 seats should be considered small or large for this exercise. So there's a lot of, interesting details there. But here's what it amounts to. Is that the FAA has been sending surveys to different airports and looking at this problem about maybe the weights being off. And, of course, the weights have to be calculated in order for the plane to have enough fuel and to be able to take off safely. I don't know if you've traveled at all, but, I mean, if you've traveled, everybody has traveled. You have seen perhaps times where they say, we need some people to move up to the front or we need some people to move to the back, and that's for the balance of the plane. That all goes into the calculations. So this might actually be a thing here in the United States. It's already happening in other parts of the world. Air New Zealand just went through a passenger weighing exercise similar to what some U.S. carriers, are looking at doing. Samoa Airlines has reportedly charged passengers based on their weight. Like the unmemorable chain restaurant, the article's author says, he went to as a kid. It ran a promotion by charging children according to their weight for meals. He talks about several of the other airlines that are doing this, and it's fascinating. So I mentioned to you that I got a laugh out of it because long ago, maybe over 25 years ago, I was flying. It wasn't Farmington, New Mexico, but it was someplace even smaller than that. And I was taking a flight back home. I probably had to go through Phoenix. And to me, it was just kind of a joke at that time. So I walked up to the counter. It's a one-room terminal, in this little podunk town. So it's just one room, and everything happens in this one room. Probably couldn't get more than 50 people in this room. And I went up to the counter, and I, you know, I'm giving my license and whatnot. And the guy behind the counter says, "Okay, Mr. Madrid, here you go. And by the way, how much do you weigh?" And apparently he had been asking all the passengers this question. So I was in the prime of my youth, and it wasn't a question that, you know, would have bothered me because, you know, there was no reason to worry about weight. But I said, "Why are you asking?" He says, "You know, well, we need to know to calculate how much fuel to put on the airplane. Like, you know, we need to make sure that we have enough fuel." I said, "Oh, in that case, I weigh 700 pounds. Please put as much fuel as you need to on the airplane." So that to me was kind of funny, but it's actually maybe going to happen now. Who knows? Maybe when you're coming up to the ticket counter, you'll actually be standing on a scale that you won't know is there. And it's kind of like the way they weigh your bag. "I'm sorry, this bag is over the limit." But that would never happen. No, it could happen. I suppose it could. Also, with regard to masks, you know, a lot of people who are wearing masks right now, believe it or not, they're not looking forward to not wearing masks. I'm looking forward to not wearing masks. But there are some people who really are into it. And some people, including some women, this according to an article in the Daily Wire, they have come forth and said that they would prefer to keep wearing the masks even after the general public has discarded them. The title of this article is "Taking Away the Male Gaze." Some women, not gaze, not spelled G-A-Y-S, but G-A-Z-E. A number of women have come forth saying that they would prefer to keep wearing a mask even after the general public has discarded them, with some of the women offering explanations such as a mask functions as an invisibility cloak or acts almost like taking away the male gaze, G-A-Z-E. The women who preferred keeping masks were interviewed by The Guardian, a UK paper. Here are some of their comments. "I don't want to feel the pressure of smiling at people to make sure everyone knows I'm friendly and likable. It's almost like taking away the male gaze, G-A-Z-E. There's freedom in taking that power back." What? Maybe it's, here's another one. "Maybe it's like I'm a New Yorker, or maybe it's because... I always feel like I have to present myself, my best self to the world, but it has been such a relief to feel anonymous. It's like having a force field around me that says, you don't see me." What? Here's another one. "It's a common consensus among my coworkers that we prefer not having customers see our faces. Oftentimes when a customer is being rude or saying off-color political things, I'm not allowed to grimace or make a face because that will set them off. With a mask, I don't have to smile at them or worry about keeping a neutral face. I have had customers get upset when I don't smile at them. I deal with anti-maskers constantly at work. They have threatened to hurt me, tried to get me fired or thrown things at me and yelled things in my face." I kind of doubt some of that's really true, but whatever. "If wearing a mask in the park separates me from them, I'm cool with that." Well, at least we'll be able to tell who the cranky people are, won't we? Another one said, "I appreciated that I felt a bit more anonymous in a mask and more gender ambiguous." I personally don't want to be gender ambiguous. "I want my gender to be well known." Someone else said, "I just stare at that little box with my face in it and pick apart my appearance. My double chin seems six times larger. My eye bags are too deep of a purple. Even when there is a heat wave and my apartment is close to 90 degrees, I will wear a turtleneck that I can pull up. I pack on thick makeup that makes my skin peel. After a full day of work, worrying and not being able to focus on my actual job, it just feels nice to blend in. Simply put, I'm sick of being perceived." We got some people with some really interesting problems, don't you think? And then here's the last one. She said, "Persistent mask wearing, even without the..." This is somebody who was maybe a counterpoint in this article. "Persistent mask wearing, even without the presence of health risks, is indulging fragile, poorly adjusted individuals to remain that way. The dependency of those who are not eagerly awaiting the unmasking of America is irrational. Personal insecurities are preventing people from surrendering the mask as well as addressing and overcoming internal issues which create this reliance. Mask wearing is fostering a sense of general distrust between and among individuals, and in this case is being used by feminists as another way to demonize men. If you walk into a public place, isn't it true that if someone's not wearing a mask, you immediately lock onto that person? Or if you're not wearing a mask, people immediately lock onto you? And further, isn't it true, whether you are wearing a mask or not wearing a mask, isn't it true that you immediately start forming assumptions about the other person? And I'm going to admit to this, okay? When I see somebody driving alone in a car by himself wearing a mask, I must admit I form an opinion about that person, and it's not a positive opinion. When I'm outside and there's nobody around me for yards and yards and yards, and I see somebody else who's outside, nobody around them for yards and yards and yards, nobody anywhere near them, and they're in the great outdoors and they're wearing a mask, I admit I form a negative opinion. I mean, because I'm judging what, why are you wearing a mask? You, there's no way that you can get the coronavirus outside, nobody near you. So it's a shame, really, if you ask me, that the mask phenomenon has caused some of these unexpected fissures and divisions in our society. And it remains to be seen how those are going to be healed. Let's go to Ken in Bryan, Texas. Hi, Bryan. Or I'm sorry. Hi, Ken. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Is this Patrick Madrid?
This is Patrick Madrid speaking to you.
Oh, my God. Air. Okay, good. Thank you. Hold it. I was driving, and now I'm pulling over on the side of the road.
Okay, probably wise.
It's better that way. That way I can pay better attention to you. So, I went through RCIA thing. Uh-huh. I was trying to become a Catholic, except I didn't go to probably over half of them because of the COVID thing. My wife didn't want me going too much, but we reached this thing. I was married like 40 years ago for about 4 years, and they wanted me to get an annulment from that marriage. No, that 40-year, neither one of us were Catholic at the time.
Okay, okay.
And it was 40 years ago. I'm 68 years old. And I talked to a priest, a very nice person, sent me a bunch of form, you know, a 59-page form to fill, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm not doing this. I'm not getting involved with involving people over 40 years ago, and certainly not my ex-wife from 40 years ago. I'm not getting her involved in this. So... Okay.
So what's your question for me then, Ken?
No, the Pope said you didn't necessarily have to do it if it was a deal breaker, but I don't know. Rules are rules. So,
Well, are you? I kind of missed that part. Are you Catholic now, or have you become a Catholic? Or you mentioned RCIA. So, are you in the process of becoming Catholic?
I wanted to become a Catholic. You know. And I got this annulment process thing, which I'm not willing to go through, partly because it was so long ago and because we weren't Catholic, and I'm 68 years old.
Yeah. Well, I'll just offer you this to consider, Ken. The question was your first marriage valid? And the only way for the church to determine if it was valid would be to do these questionnaires. Now, it's not uncommon for some people to say, you know, that was long ago. I don't want to get into that. I don't want to talk about it. And the church can still have the annulment process, even if there are people who are not going to respond. But, you know, one of the needs would be to find out what your former wife's take is on this issue. And the reason that the church does this is to determine whether or not you're free to remarry, or if you did remarry, whether or not your marriage now is valid or could be made so. So I understand and I can imagine how you feel about this. It was so long ago and all that. But if you want to receive the sacraments, assuming that you're remarried, the church needs to know whether or not this can be a valid marriage for you. And the process, I realize, is cumbersome and it's not fun, but it is necessary. And I would suggest it this way, Ken. If you want to be healthy and live a good life and live a long life, sometimes you got to go in and get a colonoscopy, or you've got to take a stress test, or you have to do something else that's annoying and difficult maybe, and you'd rather not do it. But in the bigger picture, if you do it, then you can know, oh, okay, well, I don't have any colon cancer issues. Or if you do, they can fix it and take care of it so that you don't die of colon cancer. And I would look at this in the same way. It is, you could see it as a nuisance. It's something that is difficult. But for me, I would say go through it, because then you will know that if you can be married to the woman that you're married to now, and then you can receive the sacraments and everything will be great. And that's really the bottom line. I hope that at least makes a little more sense when you consider it in that light. Ken, appreciate the phone call. That's it for me today. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. God bless you. Please pray for me and I'll pray for you.
It's so very encouraging to hear from our listeners who benefit from our program. I want to invite you to join the St. Joseph Recurring Gift Society. Your ongoing monthly gift is a gift that keeps on giving.
Learn more at relevantradio.com/Joseph.